I'm a perfect example of someone who spent his early years in athletics, did not study, had 30 college scholarship offers that I couldn't use because my grades were so bad, and then went on to write 35 books. So if I can do this, all of you can do it. You're way, way, way ahead of where I was at your age, to be sure. I drew the short straw. I have the session after lunch, which, you know, the blood from the brain goes to the stomach and the eyes roll, and so I have to kind of keep you entertained. So I'm not Cy, and I don't have a Scottish brogue, so you're just going to have to listen to a Pittsburgh accent and a couple of magic tricks. So I need you to come up and you to come up, okay? I won't make them disappear, even though this is tempting. The last time I was here, there was no net. So, I'm no magician, let me tell you. But I've got a little demonstration here, and let's do you first, okay? I'm gonna flip through this deck. Okay, you see the different cards. I want you to tell me when to stop. Okay, take that card. Got it? Okay. Hold on to it. I've got another deck here for you. If I can find what I did with it. Oh, here it is. I told you I was no magician. I thought I made it disappear, and I kind of scared myself. It's another deck of cards, and this time we're gonna shuffle this deck. Okay, do it one more time.
Was your intention to make my heart explode by asking me up here?
No, oh no, that's quite simple. Okay, not for you. I'm just pick any card. Got it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll do you first. Okay. What's the card?
Why would I tell you that? It's an ancient Chinese secret only known to a few.
Show it to them then. They can't see it.
Got it.
You see what it is? You know what it is.
Mm.
Okay.
I do.
Okay, put it back in the deck. Okay. You know what the card is?
No.
Okay, show it. Look at it. You look at it. I don't want to look at it. Okay, you know what it is? Do you know what it is? Both cases, you know what it is? You got better eyes than I got. I never could see that far. Okay, you put it back in. See, now I need to get you to put yours back in. Okay, now this is where the magic comes in. All right. I'm going to... That each one of those cards is going to go in that railing up here somewhere. So do this, hocus pocus, however it goes. All right, it's gone in there. You two guys, check. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 5, 6, and 7, the poles in 5, 6, and 7, the slots in that way. See if there are cards in there. Okay, another one? Go down one more. You never know where they're going to go. Okay. Hold them up. Okay. I'm not done. Hey, come over here. Give you your card back. Yeah, you will. I'll show them to you. Put the card back in. Back in.
Okay.
Card back in. I want you to tap top, turn the card over. Is that the card?
No.
It isn't?
Well, it's not mine.
What do you mean it isn't? I thought it was
it's her deck. I'm red.
Oh, you're red.
Yeah.
You do the same thing. Turn it over. Is that your card?
Yeah.
That's your card? Okay.
Very nice.
Thank you. That's it. All right. Now, why did I do this? I did it to entertain you a little bit, but I did it also for a teaching lesson. I'm not a magician. No one is. It's a trick. Why does the trick work? Because you don't know how it works. You lack a certain amount of information in order to know how the trick works. And also, I'm faking you out. I'm doing something to force you to believe something that isn't true. Now, how did I do that? Well, I'll show you how. On the bottom of the deck, I put two black cards. The rest of the deck is all three of hearts, every one of them. So no matter what you chose, you're going to get a three of hearts. Now, I even shuffled it for you. It didn't matter because I was deceiving you. This deck is a little different. Every other card in the deck is an eight of spades. And it's cut just a little shorter than the rest of them. So that when I flipped through the deck, the only cards you saw were the cards that weren't the eight of spades. And so, you say, well, they know I saw that card, so they take this card, and it is the eight of spades. So, in addition to people stacking the deck, only giving you the information they want you to have, there are others who will trim the story. They will trim the facts. They won't tell you all the facts. And they'll keep some facts that you never see. That is the nature of fake news. First, it starts off with a lack of knowledge. You don't know what's happening because you have no knowledge of the situation. And you also, it's oftentimes I come up here and I get this nice introduction. I've written 35 books and all that sort of thing, and a lot of people would think I'm an authority on stuff and might believe me because I'm an authority. But that doesn't necessarily mean that as an authority, and I may be a really great authority on something, but I still may be lying to you. You got to keep those types of things in mind. So what I want to do is, look, there's a lot of fake news out there, and I'm not going to go through all the fake news that's out there. Because we'd be here all week. That's all I'd be doing. And you know that there's a lot of fake news out there. You just don't know what it is because of this deal how I just tricked you. Some of it's stacked against you. Some of you don't have enough knowledge in order to determine what it is. So what we need to do is come up with a methodology to help us deal with anything that's fake in any area of life. Now, you're obviously younger than I am, and so over time you gain knowledge of things and you'll get better at it. But what you need is a technique to help you through it and also practice. Everybody has different learning styles. I don't learn well by just listening to somebody. I'll hear somebody's name and forget it like half a second later. I don't necessarily do well reading unless the story is very good and I have certain associations I can make with it. When I was in seminary, I went to seminary. You have to understand something. I became a Christian my senior year in college. I was on a track team. I threw the shot put, discus, and javelin. I was actually, I know this is hard to believe, I was a nationally ranked high school shot put. I threw over 64 feet in high school with a shot put. If you don't know I used to hold the Pennsylvania state record in the shot put. I lifted weights. I bench pressed close to 400 pounds in high school. Did a clean and press with 320 pounds. I am a shadow of my former self. The thing is with all of this is that over time, I've learned a great deal about other types of things because it's the kind of work I do, but it's something I like. I like the competition side of things. I like to find out what the truth is. I want to be able to debate the topic. I want to understand the operating assumptions of a worldview. As Cy probably told you, you have to get down to the basic belief patterns of something. What are they basing their beliefs on? What assumptions do they have? And you've got to get to the root of those assumptions if you're going to be a good debater in terms of fake news. And what we have today is a lot of people who are using the Bible, for example, in order to make their case. Liberals using the Bible to make their case. The latest one, I think it was yesterday, one of the women on The View said that Jesus would attend a gay pride parade. And isn't it interesting that liberals who hate the Bible on so many things will turn to the Bible when it seems to suit their particular cause? And so my question to you would be, how would you deal with that? Let's say they got some competition and they want high school and college students to send in why they should be on The View for a day. When I was growing up, there used to be this program called Queen for a Day. They bring these three women in who apparently had terrible home lives. You had to tell this sob story about how bad your life was. And they'd bring you on and they shower you with gifts, but only one of the women would be the queen of the day. Put a crown on her, and it's a mushy, mushy show. But anyway, let's say they have a contest and you're on that show. How would you answer a question like that? Oh, Jesus would not only go to that gay pride parade, but he would approve of it and even applaud it. How would you answer that? And those are the types of questions that we're dealing with in our world today, because I believe the fundamental problem in our culture today isn't the secularists, aren't the materialists. They're only acting like their presuppositions force them to act. We expect them to think a certain way because we know they're operating assumptions. What we as Christians have to do is to think biblically, to answer these biblical throwback questions, trying to undercut the biblical worldview. And I believe that in the church today is where the biggest problem is, because number one, Christians capitulate to the culture. And number two, they don't know how to answer the objections when they're raised. And so they keep quiet. And so what I want to do in the short time that we have is to kind of equip you with some real-life situations, real-life topics that I deal with on a regular basis and I see all the time. The first thing I want to do is to see what the Bible says about this type of thinking, the fake news idea. I'm going to run through a couple of these passages and just to kind of show you that the Bible is up to date, that what we're seeing today in our culture isn't anything that's new. It's been around since time immemorial. The very first temptation was a fake news temptation. Has God said? Well, he didn't say we could do this or that, but the questioning of a biblical absolute. 1 John chapter 4, verse 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. False prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. Now, Peter's talking about what was going on in his day. Now, this is applicable to us today. And if you read down further in verse 3, it says, and in their greed they will exploit you with false words. Their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. So we see this as, quite evident Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, examine, that is, test everything. Hold fast to that which is good. And let's see, I'm going to go through some of these quickly. My favorite is in Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. And if you know anything about the construction of the New Testament, the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts are written by the same author. And so when you read the New Testament, you really ought to go, when you're in Luke, you really ought to go from Luke to the book of Acts, because the book of Acts grows out of everything that you find in the book of Luke. But notice how Luke begins his epistle, his gospel. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. It seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. And so there are a lot of critics out of Christianity to say that Christianity isn't scientific, that Christianity isn't a rational faith. But see, the basis of science and the basis of rationality is found actually in the character and the attributes of God. Why are we rational? Why are things rational? Why is reason reasonable? Because we have a reasonable God. The sense the world makes sense. This is why if you study history or music or economics or politics or whatever it might be, the sciences, chemistry, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, all those guys, they were Christians. They believed that the world was rational because God was rational. And although there were miracles in the world, they were few and far between, and they were very specific purpose. They were never designed for the investigation of the world. If you couldn't figure something out, you had to say, well, there was a miracle attached to it. That's not the biblical method, and that isn't the scientific method. Scientific method grew out of a Christian worldview. You'll find a lot of seculars who will claim that isn't the case, that Christianity and science were at odds with one another. And they say, well, look at Galileo and so forth and so on. Well, look, Galileo, the church at that particular time when Galileo came along, had adopted an Aristotelian worldview. I mean, it was Aristotle who believed that implements of different weights fell at different speeds in a vacuum. He wouldn't have said a vacuum. But he never tested it. It's amazing. Never tested it. It was Aristotle who believed that the earth was the center of the cosmos and everything revolved around it. And the church in that particular time of Galileo had adopted an Aristotelian worldview. Galileo, who was certainly not an atheist at all, wasn't even an agnostic. He was just saying that the heavens were designed by God, and we should look at the heavens and believe in terms of what the heavens are telling us. And so Galileo was actually investigating in terms of a biblical worldview rather than an Aristotelian worldview. So it's important that we understand that we live in a rational world and that we should investigate everything carefully from the beginning. Your job is to investigate, no matter what it is. Don't let anybody pull the wool over your eyes unless you investigate it. As you get older and you make a little bit of money and someone comes to you with an investment idea, investigate it. Oh, it sounds good. Well, these tricks look good, didn't they? I mean, I saw the reaction on your faces when these guys pulled those cards out and held them up. Wow, this guy really can do magic. No, well, of course, you didn't know that, but you still reacted in such a way. Well, people will come to you and they'll want to do magic for you, try to make you a lot of money. Investigate. No matter what you're doing, you need to investigate. I was driving up here from the Atlanta area. Someone had called into a radio show, and he made this outrageous claim on the radio show. And he was spouting fake news. And eventually, the host of the show had to cut this guy off because he wouldn't let the host of the show counter with an argument. He says, you're not right. I've investigated this. Let me show you. This guy wouldn't want to hear it. Didn't want to hear the investigation of it all. So finally, the guy hung up. And it was amazing the number of people who called into the show with all kinds of counter arguments to this to this leftist who had called in saying that what the host of the show was saying was wrong. And you need to be in an investigative mindset with everything that's out there. Don't be fooled on your own. The lack of knowledge is, you know, some of the things that are the problem. People just don't know. What reminded me of these two tricks is Charles Babbage. If you have a computer, you can thank Charles Babbage for it, because he was the first person. He was a guy that lived in the 19th century. He was the fellow who believed that a programmable computer was possible, and he developed a mechanical programmed computer. This is before the onset of electricity and that was applicable in so many different fields. And he came up with these three concepts about how things are faked and forged. He started off by saying forging, and this is in the area of science, but it applies to everything. The outright invention of data, that you will find people actually make stuff up. There was a group that literally made up what looked like scholarly papers. And they did this for a purpose. They made up all the facts, and the subjects were so outlandish, but they wrote it in such a way that it was scholarly with footnotes and everything else, and sent it to some of the finest, well, what is perceived to be some of the finest science journals out there, and they were accepted. And yet the entire thesis of all these papers was completely false. The thesis was false and the information was false. And what they were doing was showing that this is how gullible people are of believing anything if it looks scholarly. But the other thing is, there are actually people out there who will forge the data for a government grant, to be accepted by their peers. There are all kinds of reasons why people will actually take those chances. And there have been examples of this in history and even in fairly recently. The other one is trimming. That one card deck I had, I said that, you know, each one of those eight of spades is trimmed just a little bit so you can't see it when I flip through the deck. And it's the cosmetic massaging of data to display them to best advantage. And look, we all do this. When you do a resume, you're going to write on your resume all the good things about you. I doubt if you're going to put in here, well, here are my faults. You know, this isn't Amazon. When you go on there, and I always look at number, you know, the people who have given it one star or could give it no stars if I could. I always look at those first. See, but when you go and give your vital information about yourself for a job, you're going to put the best slant on it as possible. Now, if I were hiring you at one of my companies, one of the questions I would ask you would be, tell me what some of your weaknesses are. No one wants to talk about their weaknesses. Well, that's the same thing in scholarly circles. No one wants to lay out the position that's faulty. There may be some government grant money involved, so you're going to try to make it as good as possible. And the third thing Babbage says was actually cooking the data, discreetly losing or hiding the data that does not support the hypothesis. And that happens all the time. And I do biblical research, and it's when I'm looking at certain passages and I'm trying to figure out what a text means, and I turn to a commentary, and I know what other people have said about this particular passage, and this guy ignores it completely. Or he... One of the things that changed my, when we talk about eschatology tonight and tomorrow, I think, I'll give you some, you know, information on that. I said, why didn't this guy deal with this particular passage? Why is he cooking the data here? Why is he making it look a lot better than it actually is? And that's the problem we face today. So when we start talking about fake news and these other types of things, keep in mind this is an ethical issue. Exodus 20, verse 16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. It's ethical. This is about telling the truth. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. you've got to compare your sources. And this is one of my favorites. We probably use it, you know, quite a bit. The first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him. Proverbs 18:17. And you encounter this all the time. I run into people who are, I grew up with a guy, I didn't really grow up with him. I got involved with this fellow when I was going between my college. It took me 5 years to graduate from college. I took a year off to find myself. Not really. I did it because college was kind of boring. But I knew I needed my college degree to do some things. But anyway, I worked with a fellow who, his family was great at working on cars. They could take a Volkswagen and cut the body in half. Crashed on the back end, crashed on the front end, take those two and put them together and make a brand new Volkswagen. And then they would go out and they would meet in a place that wasn't their address, and they would put an ad in the paper, and they said, got a brand new Volkswagen, completely renovated, and it was. Looked brand spanking new. They were that good at it, and you would think they would just stick with that. But what they did is they took the deposits of, if 30 people showed up and said, well, we need a $50 deposit. So they would take the $50 deposit. And then when the people came back to that location, they weren't there anymore. And so this family had, say, 30 deposits of $50 that they took, and then they would go and sell the car to someone else. But they were so good at what they did. And they were so good at pushing their position. I mean, I almost believed them, even though I knew they were crooks. And I've run into lots of people like that. They are really good at trying to make their case until someone else comes along and says, "Well, wait a minute. Have you looked at this? Have you looked at this? Have you looked at this?" First person comes, seems right, but someone else comes along and says, "Have you considered the other?" That is a biblical command. Two witnesses, check your sources, and make sure that you put one witness over against another. Our court system is based upon that, cross-examining witnesses. So it's not about accuracy for accuracy's sake, although that's important. It's about ethics, telling the truth no matter how painful or damaging to your position. It's a moral imperative that you tell the truth, even though the other side may not tell the truth. Let me give you an example. I probably should have had this up for you all to see, but there's a picture of you may have seen, there's a picture of a black man holding a big white sign. And it says, "No mother should have to fear for her son's life every time he robs a store." Okay? And you think, This is just typical. This is just typical of these types of people. Da 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 da. You go on and on and on. And I've seen this thing posted online. And that, you know, as you get a little wiser, you get a little smarter, you start saying, "Is that really real? Come on!" But a lot of people want to believe that. So let me read it again. No mother should have to fear for her son's life every time he robs a store. And this was during the Trayvon Martin shooting. I don't know, how many remember the Trayvon Martin shooting? Okay, yeah, that's the problem with you young people. You're too young. Here's what the real sign says. No mother should have to fear for her son's life every time he leaves home. Someone photoshopped this, and it's easy because it's a big white placard. With Photoshop today, you can make anybody look like an idiot. And you've got to check. And it's not that we have, in some places, unfortunately, you can't tell if it's satire or not because things are that stupid out there today. How many read the Babylon Bee? Yeah. Now, I don't know if you notice it, but I have to read the Babylon Bee, and I know it's satire, and I'm saying, you know, that could be true because there's so much stupidity going on out there. And I shouldn't say the word stupidity, but ignorance. And people are willing to believe almost anything. Well, I'm going to have to go. I'm already running out of time. I haven't even gotten to what I wanted to talk about. That's just kind of introduction. So let's go through some fake stuff. And I'm taking this is fake news. These are how secularists try to use the Bible against us. The favorite Bible verse of leftists and secularists and skeptics of Christianity, what do you think it is? Yes. Matthew chapter 7, verse 1. Judge not. You're not supposed to judge. Well, let's look at, you know, I always tell people, where is that found in the Bible? So Matthew chapter 7, verse 1. Do not judge, lest you be judged yourselves. Now here, so Jesus gives a general statement, then he explains it. For in the way that you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it shall be measured to you. So Jesus isn't saying don't judge. All he's saying is you better be consistent in your judgment. Somebody who supports gun control and then is found selling guns to our enemies, that's what this applies to. If you're involved in a sexual relationship and then you're accusing someone else in a sexual relationship, this is what this is applying to. The Bible says judge with righteous judgment. And in fact, if you go on through Matthew chapter 7, actually 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount, there's all kinds of judging that takes place. And the writers of the New Testament are judging all the time. And judging isn't always a bad thing. Judges judge good things as well. So judging is something that the Bible does, in fact, deal with. Let's look at abortion. And they'll say, well, the Bible doesn't say anything about abortion. Well, technically, that's true. But how would you answer the objection that the Bible doesn't address the topic of abortion? Where would you go? There are a couple of places. Jacob and Esau, what happened? They struggled together in the womb. When Mary and Elizabeth got together, and there's the announcement that Mary is pregnant, and what did the unborn baby, what became John the Baptizer, what did he do? He leaped in the womb. Well, that's an act of consciousness. But I want to take you to a passage that a lot of people, and I'm curious to know what your own translation says. I want you to go with me to Exodus chapter 21. Exodus 21, verse 22. Let's just see what we come up with. Verse 22. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. What does your translation say, so that she, what? Mine says so that she has a miscarriage. Yours actually says that? What's the translation? Is it in an ASB? That's not in the margin, that's actually in the text. Okay. How many has a miscarriage? What translation do you have? You have the New American Standard, you probably have the same one I have. And it's what's odd and frustrating is there's a little one by that little phrase. You go over to verse 22 in the margin, it says, literally, her children come out. So this particular passage identifies the unborn child as a child called children. And not only does it say, doesn't say so that her child comes out, it says what? So that her children come out. That is, it covers all the cases. She has twins or triplets or quadruplets or she's octomom or whatever the case might be. What you see, they'll go to this passage, and I've had people do, well, the Bible, it doesn't really treat the unborn child as a human being. Yes, it does in this passage, because the word here for child is used for like Moses when he is going down the Nile in that basket, that ark. It's the same word. So here, people are trying to say that the Bible doesn't deal with abortion. Well, it doesn't do with it directly, because this is a book directed specifically to the Israelites. And what is the basis of the Israelites? What are they? Their whole thing was based upon having children. It was the nature of their idea. They never would have been considered about abortion. But this particular passage actually identifies the unborn child as an unborn child. I'm going to go through a couple more of these. Anytime I deal with the abortion issue, this is always the first question. What's being aborted? That's always the first question. You don't go any further in the debate unless you get the other person to tell you what's being aborted. And I have some here. When a woman is pregnant, that is not a human being inside her. That's what someone said. So have you followed the story lately of a baby that was born at, born 23 weeks early. So what's the argument? A woman gets to do what she wants with her own body. How would you answer that? First thing I would say is, you're absolutely right. A woman has a right to do what she wants with her own body. You want to get a tattoo, you can get a tattoo. You want to pierce your ear, your eye, your brain, whatever you want to do, you can do that. You can donate a kidney, you can donate part of your liver, you can do anything you want with your own body. The question is, what is that growing in her? It's another body. Different DNA, could be the different blood type. I mean, it's encased in a sack. Why? Because if the woman's body saw that foreign object in there, it would start attacking it. It's a completely different entity. And every time a baby is born, it's a human being. And for someone to say when a woman is pregnant, that is not a human being inside of her, then what is it? Some say, well, it's just a clump of cells. Well, that's, talk about dehumanization. You can dehumanize somebody and therefore disregard their life. They did that with slavery. They did that with the Jews. I've got this. It was a book. In fact, I saw something. I don't know if this is absolutely true or not. This could be Photoshopped. But it says, parasites don't have rights. Or the unborn child is considered a parasite, like a tapeworm. Now, I went back and did a little digging and found out that there was a booklet written in 1944 where Jews were called parasites. And the whole issue of slavery was that the slaves were what? They were considered to be property. Well, if they're property, you can buy and sell them. You can do anything you want with them. By dehumanizing someone, it's easier to enslave them and also easier to kill them. And so what we've seen today on the abortion argument is that the dehumanization of the unborn child. And, you know, I'm sure you've been around pregnant women before. And when they show their baby bump, what are they, you know, oh, it's just a clump of cells, a parasite, you know, it's just, you know, what are you going to do? No woman does that. No woman does that. Why? Because they know. They understand all of this. And so you have to steel your mind in terms of a godless, materialistic, secular way of looking at the world to look at that deck of cards as all three of hearts. And I'm going to trim the evidence such a way that I don't have to identify this as a child. And this is why, if you ever notice, if you've ever gone to a rally against abortion and people hold up, you know, aborted, you know, babies. Why is it that the people who are marching do everything in their power to hold up signs to cover it so you don't see it? They should be proud of that. Yeah, that's just a clump of cells or just parasites. Because everybody knows, and you start looking. You ever see 3D imaging, 4D imaging of unborn babies? You got to look, go online. 3D and 4D imaging. And the babies are, well, they're babies. So the arguments are, and I have a bunch more, about those, but I'll go on because I don't have much time. The next one, the fake argument. Jesus didn't say anything about homosexuality. This is kind of similar to the abortion one. Did Jesus say anything about homosexuality? Now, my first question is, so what you're saying is, if Jesus didn't say something about it, it's okay for us to do. And I haven't really heard people make that kind of argument. So Jesus didn't say anything about thou shalt not rape. He did not say thou shalt not trip blind people. You can go down the list with things he didn't say and say, well, that's not an argument. But what Jesus did say, and then we need to get back to this idea of what constitutes a proper sexual identity. Where do you go to determine that? Look, if you're an evolutionist, you can do anything you want. We'll talk about that tomorrow. If you're an evolutionist, you're an atheist, there is nothing you can't do morally. You want to be involved in a homosexual relationship? Go ahead. You want to cut off your private parts to turn you into some magical thing that doesn't exist? No, there's no stopping you. If I want to kill and eat one of you, and on the fundamental premise, I've got some stories to tell you about that. We got here. I want you to think about this a second. This is the getting to the root of somebody's argument. What standard? How did you and I get here in terms of the evolutionary theory? How did we get here? Well, a cosmic accident, but a cosmic accident dealing with the struggle for the survival of life. And how do you, this is according to the evolutionists, how did that happen? Because way, 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 way back when, the first pop-up of life over here and the first pop-up of life over here, they competed against one another and one killed and ate the other one. Who's to say that that's wrong today? Well, society says it's wrong today. Well, society said in Germany that killing Jews was okay. In fact, if you trace the history of the Nuremberg trials, after the argument was, look, we were a law unto ourselves. And it's funny that the justices at the Nuremberg trial had a trouble. They didn't know what to say. That was absolutely right. In fact, at the Nuremberg trial, the defense of the Nazis who were on trial for their atrocities were quoting United States Supreme Court justices for the basis of the foundation of personhood and dealing with morality. Now what do you do? So what did the justices at Nuremberg do? They appealed to a higher law. If they didn't do that, then what the Nazis did was absolutely right. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow sometime, whatever the time is I do it. There are these other ones. One woman wrote, this is just recently, homosexuality had to be discouraged because men needed to be with women to add to the population. That was her argument. Well, the Bible does oppose homosexuality, but homosexuality had to be discouraged because men needed to be with women to add to the population. I said, where does it say that in the Bible? It doesn't. Jesus identifies the proper sexual relationship in Matthew chapter 19, and he quotes the Genesis account. God created them male and female. And now let's just say you're a rationalist and you believe in reason. Then I can go on to say the anatomy doesn't work. I mean, the irrational idea of two people getting together and not being able to have children in nature, that would be a terrible thing for the evolutionists. So even from the biblical side until the rational scientific side, homosexuality doesn't work. And since you defined, if someone quotes the Bible, since you've defined what the Bible says about a proper sexual relationship, that's your starting point. But the New Testament and other places, Romans chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 1 Timothy chapter 1, Homosexuality is condemned in the New Testament, in the epistles. Some will say, well, prohibitions against homosexuality is similar to you can't eat certain foods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can't eat oysters, you can't eat shrimp, and so forth and so on. Well, that doesn't work either, because the punishments for eating those kinds of foods doesn't in any way match what the punishments were in the Old Testament for homosexuality. And you were just considered unclean if you ate unclean foods. But in the New Testament, what does Jesus say about these supposed unclean foods? Jesus declared, Mark chapter 7, he declared what? All foods clean. What did Peter do? And he saw the vision in Acts chapter 10. What? He saw, remember this sheet that came down out of heaven with unclean animals on it? And what does the passage say? What did God say to him? Take, kill, and eat. Peter says, I've never eaten any unclean thing. God says, don't call unclean what I call clean. Those unclean animals were meant to describe the nations. And the gospel, of course, was to go to all the nations. And so we can eat those foods today because they were a temporary symbol of something that was to keep Israel away from the nations. I won't read this passage, but the whole thing, but Colossians chapter 2, verse 16 through 23, says, therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food. If you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with use in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men? See, homosexuality is in a completely different category than eating foods. And we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1, Paul deals specifically with a sexual sin based upon the Old Testament. You can read that on your own as well. Oh, I'm running out of time here. How about the New Testament teaches socialism? I've heard this over and over and over again. It's just amazing to me how many non-Christians and secularists who despise the Bible on abortion, homosexuality, and a bunch of other things, all of a sudden grasp under the Bible when it comes to economic matters about, and they say that socialism. What is socialism? Communists come in and says, look, we're going to take over all the industry. We're going to own everything, and you're going to work for us. This is the simplest as I can make this. Socialists say, you can still own your business, but we're going to use the profits from your business to enhance the rest of society, and we're going to give them a little portion of what you have to equalize the distribution of wealth. And if that means taxing rich people up to 90%, we'll do that, to do that. And they call this democratic socialism. Now, democracy, you know, we are not technically a democracy, even though we have certain elements of democracy. You elect people to office and so forth, but we are a republic, and there's a difference. You see, under democratic socialism, if you had 50% of the people plus one person who said, we're going to raise taxes and take X number of dollars from the rich to give it to the non-rich, which would mean you would have 51% of the people in control of your property. That is not at all what the Constitution says. Even though the phrase general welfare, promote and provide for the general welfare, is found in the Constitution, it's interesting that right after that phrase in the body of the Constitution, there's a semicolon. And so provide for the general welfare, semicolon, then there is a definition of what constitutes general welfare. General welfare is something that benefits us generally, not particularly. So the mail service is general. Anybody can go to the post office, and you're not paying more postage because you're rich than someone else. The military service, that's general. It's the welfare for the whole nation as we envision it. So there is nothing within the context of socialism that finds itself in either the Constitution, and if you study the history, you'll see it's pretty bad as well. But what about the New Testament? Does the New Testament say anything about socialism? Do you know the passages that they refer to? In Acts chapter 2, verses 43 through 47, Acts chapter 4, verses 32 through 35. So basically Acts 2 and Acts 4. And they say, this was socialism, and the Bible supports socialism. But when you read those passages, you'll find out that this was all voluntary. The people saw a need. It was an immediate need. Remember, these are Jews who converted to Christianity, thrown out of the temple, thrown out of the synagogue. And they're the issue of dealing with the widows and the orphans. And so what people did as new creatures in Christ, they sold some of their property and gave it voluntarily to the elders or the deacons or the leadership of the church to have it distributed to the people who were in need. It was voluntary. If you want to be a voluntary socialist, more power to you. If this group over here decides what we want to do is we want to have a socialistic society, you can go ahead and do that. I wouldn't stop you from doing it. I'd tell you you were foolish to do it. But if that's what you want to do, and there have been socialist societies in our country, but they weren't top down forced on people to do it. It's what they wanted to do voluntarily. Forced socialism is something like you're in a class, and the teacher says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to even out the grades. And so we want everybody to have the same grade. You may have seen this illustration online somewhere. And the first day, everybody comes in, and of course, the A students, they get A's, and the F students get F's, and the D students, everybody gets their own grades. But then what the professor does, he averages it all out, and he gives everybody a C. So what happens the next time? Well, the A student, look, if I'm going to study this hard, and all I'm going to get a C, I'm just going to study to get a C. So now everybody's grade drops down back to a D. And if that's what happens, everybody quits studying, everybody gets an F. I mean, that is the nature of socialism. And our founding fathers, going all the way back to William Bradford and Plymouth Foundation, they started off as a socialistic society, basically forced on them by their financiers overseas. And they, when the Bible talks about the starving time, that's what caused it, because people who did the most work got the same amount of the people who did little or no work. So what do you think happened to the people who were doing all the work? If they were going to get the same as the people who didn't do any work. Well, they didn't do as much work anymore either. And so as a result of that, some of them starved to death. Until finally William Bradford came along and says, nope, not anymore. Everybody has their own tract of land and you're responsible for your own eats and what the people ended up doing because they needed to work in order to live. The Bible says you don't work, you don't eat. They worked, they ate, and then what they ended up doing is they traded with one another voluntarily. Government's not involved in it. You imagine today in our society if you had a government that was going to manage how you lived and how you spent and the rest of it. I remember in my seminary class, my ethics class, I had a professor in there who was new. I won't go into the whole story, but I remember this is the only thing I remember about that ethics class. I'm shamed by that this is all I remember. He got up there and he said he could not understand why there were so many deodorants out there available. That's all I remember about that class. That's bad. But I know a little more today about the ethics stuff. I wanted to raise my hand, but I was a shy seminary student, really didn't know anything. And I said, look, this is what I wanted to say. You know, I've tried different deodorants over the years. I can sweat in the middle of winter. If I go outside in the heat, I'm, 3-4 gallons of water over me. And I've tried probably 4 or 5 different deodorants, but I found one that actually works. And I like it. Smells good. Keeps me dry. I could be a commercial. But if someone says, we don't need all those deodorants, we only need one deodorant, it's going to be the state deodorant. There is no incentive to make that deodorant really work because it's the only one out there. And it's going to hurt me because I'll probably get a rash. That's what was happening. But think about that for everything. There are 320 million people in the United States. There are billions and billions of economic transactions being taken, taking place every day in the United States. There is no bureaucracy that could ever plan that. In fact, any planned economy just doesn't work. People should be free to produce and sell what they want at whatever price they want. You know, during a hurricane, you often find people talk about price gouging with gasoline and hotels, and they say, "Oh, we're going to put price controls on it." Well, what happens is when you put price controls on the thing, then you got a family in there. Like, I have 9 grandchildren, so we all of our family. We got to be 6 adults and 9 grandchildren. We need rooms to say, "Oh, they kept the price low, so let's get 3 rooms." So that shuts other people out because the price is pretty good, you know, the way it is right now. If they had took the price controls off, the price would go up, but there'd be availability of rooms. See, when the state gets in, forcing people into compliance about selling this and that at this price and that price, it doesn't work. And what ends up happening, people end up losing their incentive to make money. Are there economic disparities in the United States? Yes, there are. But I can guarantee you, if the government got involved, it'd be a whole lot worse. How about the phrase, "You Christians need to," the Bible says, "render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's." That's in the Bible. Well, you know what my first response to that is? What would your first response be? Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. The context, yes. Anytime you read a Bible passage, Judas went out and hanged himself. "Go thou and do likewise. Whatever thou doest, do quickly, because there is no God." Those are 4 Bible verses, but taken out of context. So context is important. So we've established the context is that what's happening there? Jesus is being what? He's trying to be tricked. He's trying to do what I did up here, but Jesus knew what the cards were before the trick started. But what would be your next response? It's so obvious that people miss it. Okay, that's another part of it, but the very next thing is, we don't live under Caesar. People say, "Well, we have a constitution of the United States," but we don't live under Caesar. We live under the Constitution of the United States. Can we change the can we change the political philosophy and action of our government? Of course we can. What's the First Amendment to the Constitution say? What's the 4th aspect of the First Amendment? We can petition the government for a redress of grievances. See, we can change our government. Caesar, you couldn't change it. Unless you were a Roman citizen, and even then you couldn't change it. I mean, the Apostle Paul, who was a Roman citizen, ended up getting beheaded by the Roman Empire. So when people say, "Well, you need to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's," and then the rest of it is, "And unto God the things that are God's," and who's under God? You and I, and who else? Caesar. So what is our Caesar, if you want to say render unto Caesar? What's our Caesar today? Constitution at what level? 2 levels, state and federal. And 9th and 10th Amendment are very clear about the relationship between the federal government and the state government. I've run out of time. I've got more stuff here. Maybe I'll touch on some of these things and some of these other. I'll try to squeeze them in. Flat Earth, other kinds of goofy stuff. Okay. Thank you all.